Mind-body medicine. Yes, it's cutting edge, and yet, if you look through history, it's been cutting the edges since before the times of the Romans, and I'm sure since shamans started doing their thing. Internist Dr. Howard Schubiner is currently on the forefront, curing undiagnosable pain. Unlearning Your Pain is how he calls it, and it's also the title of one of his books. I'm Robin. Stay tuned as he shares some of his great findings. This is Tributaries. Howard, thank you for your pioneering and observant attention to mind-body medicine and for really leading the Western medical model and community forward. Do you feel like you've made it to the medical mainstream yet?
Great question. You make me sound like I'm on a stagecoach or something.
Well, didn't it feel like that sometimes for you back in the early days?
Well, you know, what's funny is that people think that when they come up with ideas that they're new. And generally, I've found if you study history, they're not. And so when you look at the history of the field that I work in, you know, mind-body medicine, the connection between the brain and the body, I mean, you know, this goes back to Roman times and, you know, a couple thousand years ago, Ovid, you know, said when the mind is ill at ease, the body suffers. And so, you know, any astute observer, you know, if you pay attention, you will see what we are seeing. And it's modern medicine that's blind,
yes,
myopic in so many ways. And it's almost humorous in a way that things can be right in front of you. There was a recent letter to the kind of a little publication in the New England Journal of Medicine about a doctor was writing in about an interesting patient who had all these problems, you know, all these different pains, all these different issues, and nobody could figure it out. They could never find anything wrong. And then this person got diagnosed with, I think, a cancer or something. And he said, you know, all those other things just went away, and we never figured out why. It's like, Jesus, how hard is that? I mean, and our patients, you know, the patients that come to us, they say, you know, Dr. Schubiner, how come no one ever told me about this? I mean, it's so obvious. It's so simple when you see that, you know, people have a narrative, you know. We're meaning-making machines. We want to look for answers. And the medical community is so blinded that they can only see that if the body's broken, there must be something wrong with it. I was at a lecture yesterday on anxiety and depression, and it was like, well, we can use this drug, that drug, the other drug, this drug. Oh, we can use those drugs. Oh, then we can use these drugs. And it's like, those don't help. Not that they never help. I'm not saying that we can never use or should never use medication. I'm not saying that at all. But the studies show, I mean, the research that we have, and the same thing is with pain. We are very ineffective in treating chronic pain. We are very ineffective at treating chronic anxiety and depression. And often the treatments work no better than placebo treatments. We're talking about injections, we're talking about surgery, we're talking about medications. And yet, when you open people's mind and begin to look at their lives, not just look at what their symptoms are, you know what I'm saying?
Of course, yes.
Their lives, right? Look at who they are and where they came from and what their experiences were. And you begin to look for simple connections between the mind and the body, between connections, between when somebody felt endangered or unsafe. You know, children are canaries in the coal mine, right? Children are canaries. They're the ones who, you know, when they're having stomach pain or they're having asthma or they're having headaches, there's something wrong in their life. And their brain is trying to alert them and alert their families that there's something wrong. They're feeling unsafe in some way, shape, or form. And this is hardly rocket science.
Right. And it's hardly, just as you mentioned, the reason for grabbing for the next pharmaceutical, and I heard a friend recently call it a harmaceutical, and I had to see a lot of relationship there. And you work with folks that have chronic pain that does not have a structural physical source, and you have incredible successes where pain completely is relieved. So could you share an example and over time, how this has affected your thoughts about medical diagnosis?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I trained as a traditional doctor, and I was very proud of being the best doctor I could be and learning everything that I could possibly learn. But yet, I didn't see this. I didn't understand this hardly at all. So I had a whole career as a medical school, you know, professor and faculty member for 18 years, rose in the ranks. And when I left the university, my medical school in Detroit, Wayne State University, and went to a community hospital because I was offered a kind of a, what I thought was a cushy job there, my boss said, well, you should, you know, you're kind of, you know, I'd been studying meditation and mindfulness by that time and teaching that. And my boss said, you know, you should maybe read this book by Dr. John Sarno. And this was in 2002, because his close friend had a pain problem that was basically completely cured by reading a book. And this is amazing, right? And this happens, you know, not that rarely. It does happen. And so I read the book, and I was just like, oh, yeah, mind-body medicine. Yeah, I was kind of interested in that back in my college days, and I'm interested in mindfulness. So I went to study with Dr. Sarno and talked with him and learned from him, and I came back to our hospital, and I said, you know, I think maybe I should set up a little clinic and see what I can learn. And so what I did then, Robin, I just started talking to people and listening to them and taking time. And I'll never forget one of my first patients was a wonderful middle-aged lady with headaches for 17 years, every day, daily, chronic, severe headaches, incapacitating headaches for 17 years. Can you imagine that? And nobody could help her. She'd been to headache clinics and tried all these medications and injections. Nobody could help her. What could I do? Well, I could listen to her, which nobody had done. So what was her story? Her story was that she grew up in a family that was, you know, relatively average, she thought. But her father was kind of unpredictable. And sometimes he would come home from work and be happy and fine. And other times he would come home and be in a mean, bad mood. And he would yell and scream. And he might grab her and say, "What's wrong with you? Can't you do anything right?" And it was extremely scary to a young girl. But that was her life, and it didn't happen every day. And she grew up, and she got married, she had kids, she had a job. And then one day she got a new pair of glasses. And when she put those glasses on, within 5 seconds, she got a pain in her head. And the pain didn't go away for 17 years. And they got new glasses and different lenses, and they thought there was something wrong, but it turned out the glasses was a trigger. Getting the glasses was a trigger for something going on in her brain, the danger signal in her brain. And so I asked her, what was going on in your life at the time you got that new pair of glasses, right? And she said, I don't know. You know, my husband was okay. My kids were okay. You know, well, I don't know. Maybe I guess I had a new boss. Well, what was your boss like? Well, he was very unpredictable. He would be fine, he would be okay, and then sometimes for no reason he would just yell or scream or get upset or be critical. I don't know, do you think that has anything to do with it? And it's like mind-blowing how simple and amazing that is, and how our brains, like I was saying, kids are canaries in the coal mine. Our brain is there to protect us and help us and guide us and send us messages.
Yes.
But our brain can't tap you on the shoulder and say, you know, my dear, you really got to get out of that job. Your brain just gives you this pain and you don't understand. And then it gets worse and worse over time because you're going to doctors and getting medical care that's frustrating and not helping. And, you know, sometimes, of course, it helps. But when it doesn't help and these things become chronic, you know, people have nowhere to turn to.
Right. And as you mentioned with the brain and the pain, the brain will process physical pain and emotional pain in the same way. So therefore, there's the pain. And so it can be dealt with in a similar way, I'm assuming. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. Research shows, we've got tons of studies now. This is not kind of like,
You're on a paved road now, Howard.
I mean, this is real science. This is just the science of the brain. We know that the brain, when you give someone a physical injury and you scan their brain using fMRI, and then you give them an emotional injury and you scan their brain using fMRI, you see the same thing. So physical pain and emotional pain are the same in the brain. And it is not the body that causes pain. When you touch a hot stove, your finger cannot cause pain. It can send signals to the brain, but it's the brain that decides, and this is important, it literally decides whether to turn on pain or not. And we know that because lots of people throughout history and well documented have had minor or severe injuries and had no pain at all. And so the brain decides whether to turn on pain or not. So all pain is derived from the brain. All pain is generated from the brain. And therefore, the pain that one feels when one has a physical injury is exactly the same as the pain one can feel when one has an emotional injury. It's the same pain. And so all pain is real. It's not imaginary. It's not all in someone's head. It's not fake. It's not because they're weak or damaged or broken. It's how the brain works.
Yes.
And in the end, it's a guide. It's there to teach us or tell us something if we can figure that out.
Yes. And you've been kindly accused of changing the landscape of how clinicians conceptualize physical health and the connection between emotion and health. And your groundwork into chronic pain really does serve all fields of medicine. Is there any bit of feedback you've gotten from either a patient and or a doctor that went out further than you even imagined this work could do?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, it's not me. I mean, this is
no, but it's your field of expertise.
This is science.
Yes.
This is, you know, I'm so proud to be part of this movement. I have my personal roots in the late 60s and early 70s, and I was taught to question authority and change the world, right?
Yes.
So I'm so happy to be a part of this and to, you know, play my role. There's lots of people doing this work, not as many as we need. And we need thousands and thousands more people doing this work because so many people are suffering. And there's a lot of room for growth and expansion of these ideas. For example, you know, when I started doing this work, and you know, I mentioned Dr. Sarno. He started doing this work in the 80s and 90s. It was truly a pioneer and trailblazer. And his books are still selling amazingly well. But he didn't have the advantage of the science, the neuroscience that we now have.
Right.
He didn't have the advantage of the imaging studies of the brain that we have. And now we have randomized controlled clinical trials showing that this work is efficacious and more efficacious than standard methods. So we have all of that now. So it's a tremendous advantage. I mean, so when people read Dr. Sarno, they'll say, well, it seems like this mainly applies to back pain. But when you read his later works, he's talked about, you know, heartburn and headaches and irritable bowel and fibromyalgia and a whole variety of things, but it's also anxiety and depression. When you take chronic pain, anxiety, depression, migraine, back pain, fibromyalgia, you take those things, those are the major causes of disability in the world, by far. They're not the major causes of death in the world, because those are heart disease, cancer, stroke, lung disease, etc. But they're the major causes of disability. But when you start to think about a whole range of other things, what about eating disorders? You know, what about anorexia, bulimia, you know, what's causing those? Well, if you look at them closely, there are situations where people have been, you know, under extreme stress and or trauma. And this is another reaction that the brain may have to stop eating. You know, you have control over what you eat or not. What about substance use disorders? It's a whole nother area that we really haven't scratched the surface on very much. Gabor Mate has written about that. What about now we have long COVID, you know, and we have all, and we have chronic fatigue, and this is a huge and controversial area. Tons of research and papers and articles coming up every day, every week on this. We're right there. This is part of ways we can help people.
Yes, let's question all of these things. And the audience, I think, is right there with us. So when you talk about root causes, and I'm glad you just brought up long COVID, let's go there. I've heard you say on another recording about how long COVID, people that suffer from that, have a lot of fear. So we need to get to root causes of fear, the trauma that's causing it. We have a lot of the scientific diagnoses with all of the equipment now. But I also loved how you brought up that, yes, it's a good thing, but also when you're looking at a 70-year-old's disc that is degenerating, everybody's discs eventually start degenerating and it can create a lot of pain and they can be helped by surgery. But all of a sudden, how many times are you exploding the fear factor here, right? It brings someone into fear, and then are all of the operations necessary? I think that's showing as well that surgery, like the drugs, are being depended upon more than perhaps is needed.
Yeah, well, if you want to talk about chronic neck and back pain, we just finished a study where we evaluated 220 people with chronic neck and back pain using the methods that we use. So the traditional method is, well, you have back pain, let's look at your MRI and see if that will tell us the cause of the pain. Well, an MRI can't tell you the cause of the pain unless the MRI shows a tumor, a fracture, an infection, or an inflammatory condition. If the MRI shows bulging disc, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, facet arthropathy, all these kinds of findings, these findings occur in normal people. And they increase with age. And so if you're talking about disc bulging, 80% of 50-year-olds have that with no pain. 90% of 60-year-olds have that with no pain. So the traditional model is to assume that the pain must be coming from the back, because what else could it be coming from, number one? And number two, you see these abnormalities. But they're not actually abnormalities. It's like saying your scalp hurts because your hair turned gray. I mean, it's just simply the same as that. Or that you have arm pain because you have, you know, your skin is not as elastic as it used to be when you were younger. So it really makes no medical sense. And what we have found, if you listen and you take the time to talk to people and hear their story, you will find that the pain they have is variable. It's maybe worse in the morning and better in the afternoon, or it goes away when they're on vacation, or it's worse when they're sitting in their car but not worse when they're riding a bicycle, or it's triggered by the weather or by sound or by stress. And when you take that information, which is readily available, anybody could ask these simple questions, then you can actually, what we call, rule in a mind-body condition, as opposed to saying, well, we don't know. Well, your x-rays and MRIs are abnormal, so maybe it's it, maybe it's not. But we can know. So in this study with the 220 people, we found that 88% of them, their back pain, chronic back and neck pain, was not structural. It was purely mind-body pain, 88%, which is actually shouldn't be that unusual, shouldn't be that surprising, because roughly 90 to 95% of people with chronic headaches and migraine are non-structural. They're called primary headaches. The vast majority of people with chronic stomach pain and pelvic pain, non-structural. So it really fits in with, you know, this whole chronic pain model. So why would we want to operate on people's backs when the pain is not due to their back. There has never been a randomized controlled trial showing that back surgery for back pain is better than physical therapy or exercise or just not operating. So there's no medical science for these surgeries. Sometimes surgeries may help people, but that may be because of a placebo effect. And about a third of the time, people who get back surgery will actually get worse.
Right, yes.
And that would be called the nocebo effect.
Yes.
And if you have somebody who's been traumatized in their life, they were hurt or neglected or abused or abandoned as children, and then maybe had more abandonment or neglect or abuse later in life, and now you operate on them, well, how's their brain going to take that?
Right, that feeds right into all of that.
Right?
Yes.
It's like an assault. It's scary and maddening what we're doing in modern medicine.
Right.
In this
and
particular field.
I want to get into how you can interrupt that pain. But first, there's got to be which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of scenario, because it's brilliant to work with chronic pain that has no physical reason for happening after you get all these tests done. But what created the malady? I mean, yes, somebody can fall and obviously they hurt their hip because they landed on their hip or something like that. But why did they fall? You know, why did they fall? Was it because they were depressed and not paying attention? And so the mindfulness could help with also the physical malady as well, of course. Can you address that? And perhaps along with that, where does that leave somebody with responsibility? Because that can add such a huge layer of, oh my gosh, this is all my fault. And then that's kind of depressing. And where do you stand with fault in cause of disease in the body or pain?
Yeah, I think if you, as I said, if you really take the time to listen to people and understand who they are, where they're coming from, what their life experiences were, you will have a great flow of empathy for them. And that's one of the most important things that I've learned in doing this work now for 20 years. When I started it, I thought I was a reasonably empathic doctor. And I nowhere near what I needed to be and what I learned to be by taking the time and listening to stories. Mm. And when you're empathic toward the people you see, you have the opportunity to help them be empathic toward themselves.
Mm. Yes,
people
beautiful.
People who have been hurt or traumatized are often likely to be the least empathic toward themselves. They're often kind and caring and nurturing toward everybody else. And, you know, so many of our patients have seen that pattern. So it's not a question of blame. It's a question of understanding the pain and the other symptoms that people have, the anxiety, the depression, the insomnia, the fatigue. These are real. This is real suffering. And the reason that it's happening, we can figure out the reason why it's happening by hearing the story and understanding them. So it's never their fault. The question is whose responsibility is it for them to recover? And it's a joint responsibility. It's a responsibility of our society to stop hurting people, stop hurting children. It's a responsibility of our industry to treat people who work in the workplace better. You know, it's the responsibility of our society to stop marginalizing people who are poor, who are women, who are people of color, because all these things cause the kinds of hurts that can result in chronic pain and fatigue and anxiety, depression, insomnia. And so the narrative that people often have when they start out is, well, you know, bad things happened to me, and then on top of it, I got all these illnesses that piled up and got worse and worse, and I went to the doctors, and they couldn't help me. But the hero of that story is the doctors, and I'm broken. But another narrative is these things happen to me because of a whole variety of societal factors, interpersonal factors, family factors, and because of these social and psychological situations, I got these sensations, all these symptoms that I now know are potentially reversible. And the doctors couldn't help because they didn't understand it. And the hero of this story is me, because I have the opportunity to choose my attitude. I have the opportunity to choose how I move forward. I have the opportunity to rewire and change my brain with help from caring doctors who understand this, therapists who understand this, coaches who understand this, friends and family who understand this and are willing to help. That's the difference.
Yes, and here we are going back in history again to the symbols in the Chinese language, where crisis and opportunity, aren't they the same thing?
Yeah. Well, danger, the symbol for danger is crisis and opportunity.
Yeah. Obviously, you need to speak one-on-one with clients and with patients and with people with chronic pain, but what is one of your first go-tos? Is it the mindfulness meditation? Is that one of your largest tools after listening? There's such an opportunity. You've written a few books for people to learn from, and I think that can be so eye-opening just to know, oh, wow, there's a possibility here for a big shift.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So our model consists first of understanding the brain, understanding the science of the brain and how our brains actually create what we experience. And the science is called predictive processing. And we've written about that, and I write about that in my book so people can understand how the brain works. Because you can't understand pain or these other symptoms unless you understand how the brain works. The second part, then, is to do the assessment, where you're looking, as I mentioned, looking at the sensations and the symptoms carefully, understanding them, looking at your life narrative and looking at how the sensations may come and go, shift and move, etc. And again, we have information on that, and there's a chapter in my book on how to do that. And most people can do that for themselves, because it's actually not that hard. It's very obvious. Most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, it's very obvious. That's the second component. So now people understand how the brain works. They understand that it's their brain that's creating their sensations. Now we can move on to how to rewire the brain, how to turn off the danger alarm mechanism that is in the brain. And that consists, we think of that in two arenas. One is called PRT, pain reprocessing therapy. And the other is called Emotional Awareness and Expression Therapy, EAET. And we've done research and studied both of these, and they both have been found to be effective independently. We use both of them together. And the pain reprocessing consists of teaching your brain that you're safe, learning that you're safe. And this consists of understanding, knowing on a deep level that you're not damaged, talking to your brain, soothing your brain, doing mindful awareness type exercises as well to separate from the sensations and allow them to be there without being as reactive, as fearful of them, as frustrated with them as one might be, and to start doing a graded exposure techniques where we're starting to teach the brain that it's okay to bend, or okay to walk, or okay to sit, or okay to eat certain foods. And we're doing that starting little by little and teaching the brain, knowing that this is reversible. The emotional awareness and expression side of it is to deal with the underlying stress and the emotions that people have had in their life. So frequently, psychotherapy is teaching people, well, you know, if you're anxious or angry, we've got a medication for that, or we can help you modulate that and just, you know, we don't want you to be, you know, angry or anxious or sad. We can just, you know, you just kind of notice those feelings. But what we want to help people do is identify and express those feelings in safe and healthy ways, rather than holding them in, holding them back, modulating them. And it turns out that this is can be extremely therapeutic and help people with current life stresses and also prior life stresses. And we use a technique called a memory reconsolidation, where we help people go back in time in a visualization to help not to relive their traumatic events, which is cruel and horrible, not to relive them, but to change them from the point of view of memory, changing the actual memories, changing the emotions. And so we're helping people to have more agency and control over their mind and their lives, and also repair relationships and have more connection to themselves, caring and compassion for themselves, and reaching out to others who can help them.
Yes, and I'm wondering, is microdosing moving into the picture with this type of work at all?
That's on the horizon. It's, you know, not quite legal yet, and but we are starting to move in that area for some people. Not everyone is going to need that, certainly, because most of the people we see, we've been able to show that they can get better and certainly even reverse their symptoms completely by using the methods I described. But, you know, no one can say that any one technique is 100% successful for anything in medicine.
Of course.
And so, yes, and I've personally had some experience with using psychedelics for people with chronic pain or anxiety or depression. And that's a big area of research and development going on now. So I'm sure in the next few years we'll be hearing a lot more about.
It would also seem that your job as doctor from this vantage point could really move into a spiritual consult. Do you ever feel that? Certainly not proposing any religion.
Well, that's another area that I've learned a lot about over these last 20 years that I've been doing this work. And from religion, I've met a lot of patients who have strong religious affiliation, and I can see how much that has helped and how we can tie into that and help use that to support people. I'm a believer that I'm not a person for myself. I'm not personally huge, organized religion is not a huge part of my life. On the other hand, to throw out spirituality would be a huge mistake.
Right. Well, there is a difference, too, right. I think, between spirituality and organized religion.
Exactly. So to think that we are not spiritual beings, or that spirituality and spiritual types of experiences can't help people, would be that would be myopic, I think. And so, obviously it depends on the person. But I've seen, over the years, I've seen a lot of folks who have found great help and relief by what one might call spiritual work, in addition to the types of therapy type things that I've mentioned.
Yes. Now, is there anything, Howard, you would like to say in closing about the direction of this field, or anything you've experienced that is really coming up right now into your focus?
Well, the two things that I would say. One, we touched on long COVID before, and it's a really important area, because this long COVID will give, it's kind of like a crossroads, because you can look at it as there's certain people who've had severe COVID who certainly may have ongoing heart or lung damage. And that's true. But that's not what we're talking about in general when we're talking about long COVID. The vast majority of people diagnosed with long COVID have symptoms that are not objective, like headache, fatigue, brain fog, GI issues, a whole variety of things that are real, not imaginary, as I said before. and can create tremendous suffering. But in general, with those clients, we have not found medical disorders to explain them. We have not found the damage in the body. Many of the folks who have long COVID may not have actually had COVID, have negative antibody tests. The fear about COVID has driven a tremendous amount of these symptoms, and we've treated many people successfully using our simple methods to completely reverse long COVID. And it's a crossroads because it's a crossroads for medicine, because it's a tremendous opportunity going forward for people to see the mind-body connection and use the mind-body connection in ways that can help relieve suffering in simple, low-cost ways, using real neuroscience, real science, and using methods that we have found to be effective in randomized controlled trials. So in going forward to the other part of your question, going forward, we have a tremendous opportunity now to break open this whole arena and stop harming people with medical treatments that have not been shown to be effective and that are often invasive and can have serious side effects and adverse events due to them. And we have the opportunity now to move forward into a space where the main causes of, as I said before, the main causes of suffering and disability in the world can be addressed in these ways. And you can't keep a good idea down forever.
Yes,
Victor Hugo, a long time ago, Victor Hugo said, there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come.
Yes.
And I truly believe this is the time, and it may not happen in my lifetime, but it will happen, that these models and these techniques will become mainstream, will become generally accepted, and we will save a lot of money, save a lot of suffering and heartbreak as this becomes more common in the world of medicine and in the world in general.
Yes, and one of the quotes I've heard recently that has become a favorite is, the plural of anecdote is data. I'm sure there is anecdotal evidence speaking to this mindfulness, this mind-body connection that actually reverses physical problems. The day is coming for that too, I think, where those things can be addressed and dealt with.
Yes, and you know, people definitely are moving in that direction. Gabor Mate talks a lot about that. And people with autoimmune disorders, for example, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, we know that these are immune conditions, but the brain can affect the immune system.
Right.
There's a field, the whole field of psychoneuroimmunology.
Yes.
So this is well known. This is well researched. There was an article in the New England Journal just a couple of weeks ago about cancer, and a doctor saying, you know, I always thought cancer had nothing to do with the mind, but, you know, there's this new research. We're seeing a whole variety of things. So, you know, we've got our hands full. There's a lot to work on.
Yes.
A lot to be done. And, you know, we're not going to cure all illness, because people will get sick. People will pass. I mean, that's part of life. But there is no doubt that we can relieve a tremendous amount of suffering by implementing these ideas.
Dr. Howard Schubiner, we can find lots of great help these days. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned. Thank you.